Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Stacey Thomas studied English and history at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. She is a contributor to Bad Form Review and an alumna of the Curtis Brown Creative Novel Writing Course. In 2021, she was announced as one of the three winners of the HarperCollins' inaugural Killing It competition for undiscovered writers. The Revels is her debut novel. Stacey Thomas, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I am so excited to have you on and talk about your lovely book. But our first question for everybody on the show is, why write?
Ooh, I feel like my honest answer is like, I write because it's the only thing I've ever been kind of good at. I think like I've always like written like from when I was a child and like through university. And then when I left university, I think like a lot of writers kind of stopped. And maybe it was because the idea of like, oh, you know, I'm going into the real world and you can't really make money from the arts. But I feel like in my case, as much as I loved writing at like school and like college, I never really found my voice. So it was that thing. It's like I never really found the story I wanted to kind of like write at that time. So it kind of made sense to kind of put it on the back burner. And then a few years later, when I'm kind of like, you know, got my kind of adult jobs, I just realized that the jobs I had, they were always just a job as opposed to a career. And then, you know, I kind of like got back into writing by doing a creative writing course. And then I realized that, you know, this is the only kind of like writing's the only thing I've done that felt like both a vocation and like a career at the same time. So that's the kind of the long-winded answer. But then it's like, I just love the idea of just coming up with stories and like creating characters and kind of like putting my daydreams to kind of paper.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I too took a break after I finished my degree in writing because I was like, I don't know. I had a child too. I had a toddler. Yeah. And I was like, how do we support ourselves writing poetry? Like that's not going to happen. I kind of came back to it too. So I appreciate that, you know, you kind of get this, you know, what is it? Capitalism tells you you've got to survive, right? I mean, that's part of it. So, and then you're like, oh, well, maybe there's other ways to do that. But, well, I'm glad you came back to writing because I loved the book.
Thank you.
So I kind of wanted to know, like, you kind of had an interesting experience in getting the book published.
Yes.
So do you want to talk about that a little bit, like how all that came about?
Yes. So basically, I started writing The Revels during lockdown. And basically, The Revels wasn't my first book. So I wrote this kind of YA, like contemporary, YA fantasy, with contemporary elements. And it was terrible. And I just remembered, like, it was during lockdown. I went on submission. I couldn't get an agent for it. It was just really, it had some interesting ideas, but it's just like, it wasn't the book. And I realized when I was querying agents, it was just an idea. I had two choices. I could kind of go back and re-edit it, or I could just try something new. And I just realized that that wasn't the right story. And I just didn't have the passion to re-edit it. And I realized that basically I grew up like, you know, reading historical fiction and watching like all those period dramas. And the reason why I never really wrote historical fiction before was because I was always just so intimidated by the research involved. And also because when you're just reading all these brilliant historical fiction authors, it's that kind of thing like, oh my God, like how can I kind of compete with them? Like, does the world actually need my stories? But I decided to give it a go. I spent 6 months researching The Revels, and it was only when I was given a membership to the London Library by the author Jesse Burton that I was like, oh, like an author sees promise in my story. And then it was like, okay, now I need to actually start writing the book. And then it's kind of like in kind of like December 2020 and then like the new year of 2021, like everything just kind of snowballed. I got a scholarship to attend the Curtis Brown Creative Writing course and also a mentorship from Claire McIntosh, like a best-selling author. So looking back, it seems like my writing journey, like it kind of seems like everything was kind of preparing me for that moment because I just had all these kind of, you know, good things like happening all at once. It was kind of like I won like the writing lottery. And I was just like, yeah, because I was really, like, looking back, I was just really fortunate to have so many people who believed in, like, the story I was writing, and just being really given the tools to kind of, like, you know, write the story I wanted to write. So I would just say that, like, the Curtis Brown course was, like, the making of me, and, like, so was the mentorship that Claire McIntosh gave me, because she introduced me to other authors. So she really opened the door to an industry that could be quite opaque at times, yeah, and really hard, especially if you're just starting out. So I'll never forget that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I think, publishing, you're right. I think opaque is the right word. And also, like, it is still kind of a club, I guess, in ways.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like who you know to get in sometimes, which, definitely, you know, for some people it's just finding the right agent, but sometimes it takes so much more than that to get something published. So I am excited for you that all that came together. I love that description of, like, winning the writing lottery, because I can only imagine how that felt when all that started to kind of lock together. That
was, yeah, like, when I just got the email that I'd won the Curtis Brown Scholarship, I just remember getting the email. I was like, oh God, another rejection. And I was like, oh wait, I've won this? I was like, oh my God. Like, when you're kind of just used to getting bad news, I feel like now it's like I've gotten better at celebrating it, but it was just such a surprise. And it's just like, it was just such an amazing experience. And then also like meeting my agent Liza as well, and then I'm like working with her on my book to kind of get it ready for submission to publishers. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm a debut, like, I've been interacting with other authors, and I can see that, you know, sometimes people's relationship with their agents, it can break down, it can become toxic. So yeah, I'm just really lucky to have, like, someone in my corner who's there for, like, you know, the long term, and has been nothing but, you know, supportive from day one. Yeah. And realizes that this is, like, if you want to be a successful writer, it's like it's a long game. So I love the fact that, you know, she's in it for, like, the long term as well.
Yeah. So I really want to nerd out about the mechanics of your book, but I wanted to ask you first, like, why this topic? Like, why, like, the witch craze during the English Civil War? Like, why this particular place and time?
Ooh, have you ever read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke?
It's funny you say that, because when I was reading your book, I was like, oh, I feel like there is some influence here.
Yeah, like, yeah. So basically, I just remembered reading that. Like, I watched the TV adaptation first, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I just, like, read the books, fell in love with them. But I really loved how Clarke uses footnotes in her book to kind of establish the world. And so when I was writing my YA, like, fantasy novel, the terrible one, that basically I had kind of footnotes in there. So as part of, like, the history, I kind of included bits about, like, the English witch trials to kind of build up the world. And when that didn't work, I was like, actually, I've always been really fascinated by the witch trials, and so that kind of sparked the idea for the rebels. And I feel like what I was interested, because obviously there's been a lot of books written about, like, you know, witches in fiction, which I really love, but then I've always been quite interested in the witch hunters, like, what makes, like, you know, a man decide that he's going to hunt and kill witches for money. And so I was really just intrigued by the story of Matthew Hopkins, because usually when he's portrayed in film or, like, books, he's seen as this old man, but he was only in his 20s when he got started, and he had a very commercial approach to witch hunting. He was there to make as much money, you know, as possible. And he really, like, you know, promoted his services, and, you know, he had like a companion who worked with him, John Stern, and then he would also have, like, a group of, like, searching women. So this was, like, it was a big business, and he was making a lot of money. And so I feel like with the Revels, I really kind of wanted to go into that commercialization of, like, witch hunting, and even, like, with the witch pamphlets, just all these people who were benefiting from the witch hunts.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that was one of the things I really liked about the story, is that it's, though it is about that time and place, it really is about, like, to me, and you know, obviously everyone will get their own takeaway, and you had your own intent, but to me it is about that, like the weird capitalism and greed and power behind it. Like, it wasn't, like, it kind of shows that it wasn't just about the religion, right? There was way other things going on, plus all the insecurity of the Civil War happening around them.
Yes. Yeah. Like when I was like researching it, I read a lot of Malcolm Gaskell's like books about like the witch trials. And then I also read like examples of like witch trial, like transcripts themselves. And I just remembered like, it was really terrible, but this this woman, she was accused by her neighbor and like her neighbor's daughter of being a witch. And it was obviously just complete fantasy. But it's like they just said, oh, yes, we saw the woman like turn into a dog and have sex with the devil. And it was just like, OK, basically, you're just making up this lie because you don't like your neighbor. And it's like you want to get rid of her. And this is like for you, the easiest way to do it. But it was just really interesting just seeing how people kind of use like kind of the fear of the supernatural for their own purposes. And then even as I kind of was researching it, just kind of getting into the legacy of King James, who I always just refer to as the original, you know, witch hunter, because, you know, he really wrote demonology, which set out his beliefs on witchcraft. And it was kind of like his courtiers were just like, oh, yes, this king's obsessed with witches. It's like if we want to get favor, we can kind of create our own like witch hunts or like write our own pamphlets. And that's where you get kind of Thomas Potts coming in with his the wonderful discovery of witches. Mm-hmm. So it's all that, it's like it's the money, but then it's also people kind of responding to like this popular like kind of anti-witch sentiment as well, which I just found quite interesting. Like, just I guess it's kind of like when people get into a Twitter spat and then everyone's just piling on because, you know, they want to be part of the in crowd and they don't really think about the consequences of what they're doing until it's too late.
I love like several times I think Will says it first and then Nicholas kind of repeats it throughout the book that his words were an untended flame.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love that line.
And I was like, yes, that exactly. Like, you know, once they're out there, you can't retract them. You can't take that back. So yeah, this is obviously, I have a whole podcast about writing about witches and witchcraft. So yes, this is a topic I'm super interested in, and I love how the history is woven into it, but I also love that there are the witch hunters who are hunting the unwanted, basically. Like you said, there are people that are inconvenient that they want to get rid of.
Yes.
But then this book also has witches, like actual witches.
Yes. Yes. I basically, as much as I wanted like the rebels to kind of be inspired by, the real life victims of the witch hunts who weren't like witches, I just couldn't resist having powers as well, because I always love books with that slight kind of supernatural element. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I was going through edits with my agent, she wanted me to kind of like establish the rules of magic a bit more, but then it was kind of like it went a bit too fantasy, so we had to dial it back a bit as well. Mm-hmm. But like, I love kind of coming up with those different powers and kind of like saying, oh yeah, having that speculative approach to history and be like, yes, and this is what happens when like magic got involved in those events, kind of like Susanna Clarke does.
Yeah. Well, and I love that like the magic in the book it's like adjacent to what they thought was like what the witch hunters thought magic was. But it's not completely separate. Like there are overlaps between what the witches can actually do and what the witch hunters thought they could do.
Yes.
But, you know, which to me made it seem in like the context of the book even more real because it doesn't seem like, oh, it's that, like you said, it's not this fantasy element. It's like, oh, there's in-world reasons why this magic works.
Yes. Yes. Like I really wanted to kind of toe that line because of the culture of misinformation at that time as well. So I was kind of like, I wanted, as you said, like to kind of be the magic should be kind of what they thought, but not exactly in that, like what they thought as well.
And I loved in the author's note about, cause you bring up the Witches of Scotland podcast, with Claire and Zoe, trying to like right the wrongs of a miscarriage of justice of the witch trials. And I don't know, the author's note was kind of like a little bit of icing on a very delicious cake.
Thank you.
This is like, okay. So it was, I think because there felt like in the book, Nicholas is so He's so easy to identify with, even when he is making the wrong choice, because yes. you just feel for him. Like, he's so sympathetic as a character. And then the author's note kind of like makes the whole book sympathetic. I mean, it feels that way anyway, but I think the author's note is talking and like putting it in context of what happened at that time and like how people are still dealing with the fallout of it. Just yes. kind of was like this, like, oh yes, the chef's kiss.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Like another like of my debut like author friends, Lucy Ash, like she read like an early version of The Rebels and she was just saying, oh, you're going to do an author's note. So it's like, because it hadn't been on my mind, but then it's like mm-hmm. I realized like it's a common staple of historical fiction. So I was like, yeah, I'll do one and like
yeah.
add all the information, because I feel like The Rebels, like, you know, wouldn't be where it is without kind of like all the sources I drew upon. So mm-hmm. I definitely like wanted to just acknowledge that. And then for people interested in the history, they could see like, you know, what I read and then kind of like, you know, kind of dive into it themselves as well.
I thought it was like you said, author's notes are kind of a given and to some extent in historical fiction, but I put so much of it in context, I think, of like why it's important to still tell these stories now.
Yes. Because it's like, I've started following, like, you know, as I was writing, like, you know, I discovered like the Witches of Scotland podcast and your podcast as well, and then other podcasts. And then, you know, even I hadn't realized that, you know, the witch persecutions are still kind of, you know, going on in some places in Africa. And at that time, like, I was going through edits with my book, and it actually kind of impacted like how I approached the ending, because mm-hmm. I won't spoil it, but like for listeners, but like it just made me realize, actually, I don't want to kind of tie up the solution with a magical ending where Nicholas is using his powers to solve the problem, because I feel like if people are reading it and it's like they're impacted, you know, by like, you know, that kind of anti-witch, like the witch persecution, it's kind of like you can go away just feeling despondent, because it's like, well, if I don't have powers, how can I change things? Mm-hmm. And so that just made me really kind of determined to kind of research the people who were actually fighting back against, you know, witch, like, you know, the witch hunters. So John Gall, mm-hmm. who preached against Matthew Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as a result, like, you know, Matthew Hopkins was put under pressure. So he did a pamphlet just saying, oh, you know, I don't like hunt witches for money. I just do this, you know, for the good of the people. And then obviously everyone realized it was all lies, because he was getting enough. He was getting paid so much that it wasn't really worth like having him like execute the witches, because it was cheaper to keep them alive as opposed to kind of call in Matthew Hopkins. But
yeah.
I really wanted to just show that, you know, in some cases the pen can be mightier than the sword, or yeah. you know, or your powers if you have them.
Yeah, I love the idea of like, it kind of makes you think about like, you know, the idea of writing as magic and witchcraft too, and kind of all of that sewn together. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so I do want to nerd out about a couple of the mechanics of the book. So, One of the things I think is unusual about this book for historical fiction is it is in first person present.
Oh God, yes.
And like, I feel like that is such a hard register to write in. And I loved how visceral it makes it, because you feel it puts you as if you are standing in Nicholas's shadow the whole time as yes. things are happening. So was that a conscious choice, or was that just like the register you like to write in, or like how did you make that decision to do that?
So in the past, like when I first started writing, I would write like in like third person, but it's like, I've always preferred writing in first person, because I'll read like in any kind of like point of view. But for me, like when I write in first person, like it just feels more vivid. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I was actually asked this question before, and it's like, I think when I'm like write, like a lot of the criticisms I get or like the feedback is that sometimes my characters are too much of an enigma. And I think it's because, you know, my personality, I can be quite introverted at times, so I don't really wear my emotions on my sleeve. So when mm-hmm. I write in first person, it's kind of like I kind of become the characters. So it just feels, even if I kind of still kind of struggle with that interiority, sorry, I can't pronounce It's that thing. It's like I can put myself in their shoes, and then it's like I become the character. So it's just easy for me to envision the world as opposed to if I wrote like in third person. And then I kind of just felt like sometimes when I read a book, I like reading in the first person because it's that thing. It's like I can put myself in that character's shoes, and then it's sort of like I'm experiencing the action as it happens. Like, you know, I'm not kind of observing like I'm in the story. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, it just makes everything feel more alive. And then I guess when I'm writing, I feel like maybe with some of like the dialogue I use, I don't know how it would have worked in third person, because sometimes maybe it's like, I think some of my lines could be a bit like dramatic at times. So it's like, it makes sense in the first person. I'm not sure how much it would work in the third. Mm-hmm. I just felt like for this story, like definitely the first person. And it's like my second story will be like in the first person as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I wrote, the initial series I wrote is in third person past tense.
Oh,
and
yes.
And I started it like very close POV, and then wound up having other POV characters because I didn't at that time know how to tell the story without telling the other things that were going on around the main character.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the challenges of writing in first person, is you only have your narrator's point of view, right?
Yes. Because I found that like when I was like writing, like sometimes I'm just like, thank God for Reddit, because, you know, there are some times where it's like I put too much information in, like, because I think one of the struggles is kind of setting the scene in first person, but then not doing too much of an info dump. So mm-hmm. even like stuff when it's like, you know, Nicholas is getting into a carriage, I'm kind of like, I can just say he's getting into a carriage, as opposed to, you know, he turns like the handle and he steps inside and he sits down. So I feel it's that thing. It's like making it descriptive, but then just kind of not kind of over embellishing the action. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like, I feel like when I write, like I really kind of like outline it kind of chapter by chapter. So as I'm writing, I kind of know instinctively like what to kind of cut down.
Mm-hmm. So you do outline, you're a planner.
I have to, but yeah. It's kind of like, I outlined like the Rebels, and sometimes I do it as a form of procrastination, but I'm not like one of those writers who can just kind of like pants it. Like I'd love to, because it would just make my life easier, but I feel like I need to kind of know where I'm going. I need to have an idea of who the characters are and what the story is before I feel comfortable like writing it kind of freestyle. Like even with like short stories, I had to write this short story for like this feature piece, and I was just like, yeah, I outlined the hell out of this 1400 word story, even though it was kind of, oh god, this is too much work, but I needed to know who the characters were.
Initially I would say I was a pantser, although I like the term discovery writer.
Yeah.
And now I'm somewhere kind of in between, like, because I write series, like I kind of have to plan a little bit, you know, like I don't really do outlines of the books, but I have like a story thing that has to happen in each book. And then each book has like a beginning, middle, and end. And that's it. That's all it is.
Yes.
And I just write into that. And sometimes it changes, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that happens, but, yeah, I admire people who can actually outline, because I feel like it would actually be easier in a lot of ways than just like you said, just kind of like, whatever happens, let's see where this goes. So.
I feel like sometimes it's like the grass is always greener on the other side, because I feel like when I plan, it's like my planning, like, you know, on the surface, it should be easy. Like, you know, I do my research, I outline it, and then I start writing. But it's like, even for book two, it's just been like such a struggle, because I've got all this research, but then it's kind of like, it's just been such a nightmare just trying to like cut it down into like a storyline. Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of like you're just wading through all this information, where I felt like if I was able to pants it, like I would still have to do the same level of research, but then it's like I could be more strategic about the books I'm reading, because I already have an idea of the like story. And then, but I feel like when I was editing, I did kind of pants some bits when I was like comfortable about the story I was telling. I feel like, especially in terms of Bess's character, because I really kind of expanded like who her character was as the story progressing. And I felt like that came at the right moment where I was just kind of really just plateaued with the story, because I was writing so much. It's sort of that thing, it's you just get kind of tired of the story you're writing. So her character she really reinvigorated the story and made me kind of realize, oh my God, I do really love the story I'm telling. I just needed some new energy.
Beth is a great character too. She's an unexpected. Yeah. She kind of has this, there's a whole different level of her. I don't want to spoil things for listeners. I want them to go read the book, but she just has this whole other unexpected level to her that you're just oh, what's her story?
Because it's I really, obviously with Nicholas's character, he's illegitimate, but then he's also from that upper class background. But I was really I really wanted to kind of explore the class differences, because I love Will's character. But then it's sort of that thing, it's as I was writing, it's well, why does Will get even if it's just a half pass for what he's done? Mm-hmm. But Clement, he's just kind of reviled by most people he meets. And how does that how much is that due to their personality, and how much is it due to the kind of class system in place at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Because even I think there's a scene in my book where Nicholas has teamed up with Clement, and then Will's there, and then they go to meet their host. And then it's Clement kind of, I think he does this hat service where he takes off his hat to kind of acknowledge their host's superior position. But Nicholas and Will don't do that. And it's sort of that thing, it's because, they're from a more upper class background, mm-hmm. and they have a confidence in who they are. Whereas with Clements, there's that determination to rise. But then there's also that thing that's ingrained to acknowledge his superiors. And then even with Bess, with how she speaks, because she's from a poorer background, but she's very well spoken. It's the idea who are you? Why are you putting on airs? Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting with British culture is that class system hasn't gone away, even though you think it has. And it's kind of when you just, because my next book is set in the 50s, and it's sort of that thing, it's if you were from a working class background, you might have been able to get into the grammar school, so those selective schools, but if your family couldn't afford the uniform, you wouldn't be able to go. And it was sort of that thing, it's sometimes your families wouldn't want you to go because you're going to move up a class level and your family can't come with you. And then it's also people from upper class backgrounds aren't really going to accept you. So it's that thing, it's you're caught between two worlds.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I think the thing that I think is interesting about Bess's character too is that, and I don't think it's as true in the United States, but I think that class is so tied to your accent and your speech register in the UK.
Yes.
And I mean, it is true a little bit here, but not to the extent and not in the ingrained way I think it is in the UK.
Yes. So basically, I think definitely, because there's that whole bias against Northern accents and the stereotype that if you're from the North then and you speak with that Northern accent, then you're basically not as intelligent as someone from the South, which is just completely ridiculous. But then also when you just think about, RP, which is the accents of people from an upper middle class, background. I think with RP, this was basically invented in the 1930s for presenters on the radio. So it's they made up this accent for people to speak on the radio. But then if you're going to those public boarding schools, everyone is speaking RP. So it's kind of RP is just this whole kind of coded language for people from upper class background. And it's sort of that thing, it's the language is kind of a tightrope because you only have to mispronounce one word. And it's sort of that thing, it's people will know you do not belong here. Mm-hmm. So it's it's just very it's just such a tense situation. And it's that whole thing as well, pronouncing your THs in English. They kind of do it where it's you pronounce your THs on the tip of your tongue. And it's sort of that thing, it's if you ever go on Mumsnet, which is this kind of UK parenting blog, I don't have children, but sometimes it's good to go on if you want recommendations for creams or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And also just to see sometimes, because my sister has children, so some of the posts can just be really bonkers. But it's that thing, it's like people are just losing their mind if their children can't pronounce those THs, because it's the idea if they can't pronounce it, then, oh my God, do their children not working? Are their children not middle class? So it's that thing, it's like they really want to. And I feel like with people in England or like, and the UK as a whole, I feel like sometimes people want to say that, want to belong to a better class than they are, or all that kind of thing. So there is just this whole anxiety around class. And if people feel like, you know, you're trying to pull on airs, it's like things can get very, very vicious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's funny because I think in the US, like, because we don't have true aristocracy, right? We just have very wealthy people. And
yes,
anyone can become a very wealthy person. And in theory, like not in practice, in theory,
yes,
that could be anyone. And, you know, I think about like, you know, like the people that people see, you know, like the current owner of Twitter, whose name I will not say, and his South African accent, you know, and then you have people like Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, who's from Alabama and has a Southern accent, you know. Yeah. So it's not, there is some of that. Like, I think if Tim Cook had a very pronounced Southern accent, which he does not, you know, that would be different. And maybe he did when he was younger and he's overcome it as an, I've never heard him, you know, never heard recordings of him speak when he was younger. But like, I do think it's interesting to me, like here it's like, you know, money and where you're from is your, like your zip code has more to do with your class status than how you speak. So.
And then in England, it's kind of like, you know, money is important, because when you just think about all those private members clubs, like, you know, unless you're inheriting your place, you need money to enter. But then it's sort of that thing. It's like, if you're from an upper class background, you don't need money. Like your background is, you know, often enough to open those doors, because you know, you still have all those connections. And I just remembered reading one book about the aristocracy. And it was kind of this thing where it's like, you know, the people who held all the land in the 17th century, their descendants, they're still holding on to it. So it's sort of like, it's sort of just this, in a way, it's like this kind of nightmarish conspiracy, because it's like, you know, they're hoarding all the wealth. So, and it's like, if you're on the outside of that, it's sort of like, how do you get in on the inside? And I think that's what I liked when I was writing The Rebels, because obviously you have the civil war, like, you know, King Charles is desperately trying to regain control of his country, and, you know, there are some people who were like rebelling against him because they see him as a tyrant, and there are also some people who, you know, see an opportunity. It's like, you know, well, if the king and Queen Henrietta and Maria are on their way out, then it's like, this represents an opportunity for us to move up the social scale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people were willing to take that gamble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like, and too, like that, you know, there is this like side kind of story with Bess and her father about the enclosures. Because I think that's something that, unless you're really into English history and you kind of, I think it's just something that a lot of people aren't familiar with what happened. Because it just displaced, it was like a huge displacement of common people.
Yes. Came across that like in my research. So I was really like trying to kind of dig in to kind of see like what happened. But yeah, no, a lot of people like lost their livelihoods because, you know, the levels wanted to hoard it for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just that thing, it's like, you know, life is hard now, but like life was even harder back then, because, you know, if you were poor, you know, you were dependent upon parish relief. And so it's kind of like that was a tax on the town, but like people would still be very like resentful of having to pay it, you know, especially, you know, if in times of like, you know, great hardship. Yeah. And then it's also that thing, it's like, you know, well, someone can kind of take the land you've been using to graze animals, and like you have no kind of legal resource. So it's that thing, it's like you just, like if you were poor, there was just a complete kind of, you had no rights really, like your power was just really, really limited. And so I really wanted to show that through Bess's kind of character, but then also show like a character who's determined to kind of like fight anyway to try to kind of get back what she's lost.
Yeah
And I guess maybe make him kind of like have her character mirror kind of Grace's character as well. So it's sort of that thing, it's like, you know, Bess is like a kind of, you know, child woman, but what will she be like, you know, when she's like a woman and like, you know, perhaps she's got what she's wanted, but then it's sort of that thing. It's like, well, you always want more. And it's like, well, what's wrong with that? unless you're kind of willing to cross like some moral lines to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think it is interesting that comparison between Bess and Grace in the story. It's hard to be sympathetic to Grace.
Really? Yeah, I feel like I loved writing her character because I do love like women, like in books, like, you know, women who are just like, you know, they're really ruthless and they're unapologetic about it. And then I also just feel like, you know, they're from this aristocratic background where it's like, you know, they're kind of, you know, mini kind of kings and queens of their own land. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think it's like, you don't really see kind of people outside of your family as people. And it's like, you know, if you have to kind of sacrifice people to get what you want, like, you know, often you'll do it without thinking. So I really wanted to show it. And also just to show that, you know, women, like, you know, as much as they were victims of the witch hunts, they could also be like eager participants as well. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Her story ends in an interesting way, which again, I don't want to spoil. So, but yeah, I really like her as a character, but you're just like, oh, you know, like this person.
I feel like I had like a lot of fun like writing her characters, especially her kind of like, you know, her comebacks to kind of Nicholas as well, because I quite like it when dialogue is quite like biting. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so I quite like writing like Grace because she kind of has the best kind of like put downs in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's quite fun.
Yeah, the little spars between her and Nicholas are quite fun. Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of stepping back to something you said about like feedback you've gotten about the enigmas of your characters, like, and you think that, you know, your introversion kind of.
Yes.
And I have had the same kind of thing. And I think that was also part of why I wanted to try my hand at first person, because I, you know, it's like, I don't know what this character's thinking. And I'm like, well, people don't always know what I'm thinking. Like that's, you know, but as a reader, you know, obviously that's a different experience. So I think it is interesting how much of us shows up on the page, I guess, and how we kind of have to sometimes write through our own personalities.
Yes, because it's kind of like when I was writing, it was like the feedback I got, like I'm always very receptive to feedback, even if someone I don't agree with. So even when I was doing the writing course, like, I would kind of like, I would do like this document where I'd be like, okay, this is what people have said they liked, and then this is what people said they didn't. And then it's kind of like, I would go and just see, like, even if stuff I didn't agree with, I'd just be like, okay, maybe if I just try it and see if it works, and if not, then I could just kind of, you know, kind of come up with my own action plan of how to tackle it. But I don't know, it's kind of like when I was editing it with my agent, she was just kind of like, she was kind of giving us on how to add a bit more interiority to it. Mm-hmm. And also like with my, like, ed as well. But I do agree with you that sometimes it's kind of like you're writing against your personality. But then I also feel like maybe it's like a common writer's issue where it's like, you know exactly like what your characters want, you know their motivations, you know their desires. So sometimes it just feels a bit redundant to make it really, like, you know, explicit on the page, whereas it's sort of that thing, it's like, I guess I kind of learned the hard way that, you know, the readers, like, they're not in your head, so they can't like see what you see. So it's kind of like, for me, it's like it was just that balance between not spelling things out but kind of just giving a bit more clues so that the readers feel like a bit more grounded.
I think that it's, I think, you know, and I always say, you know, each, I feel like I learn something from each story I finish, and like, hopefully that then I grow as a writer with the feedback from that. And yeah, I think it's, I love what you said about, I'm always open to it, whether I agree with it or not. Cause I think I always think about that Neil Gaiman quote about, if someone tells you something's not working, they're right. If they tell you how to fix it, they're wrong. You've got to figure out how to, you know, basically you've got to figure out how to make it work in your story. But, and I'm like, yeah, no, that has always made sense to me. And I think just coming from having done workshops, writing workshops, it got easier to separate, like, you know, my emotion around the work to the work.
Yes.
Like, yes, it's my baby, but I'm not going to die if someone thinks it's ugly. You know, that's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I feel like writing workshop, like I was really lucky in that the people on my course were great, but then it's sort of that thing, it's like not everyone is going to like what you've like written and vice versa. So it's sort of that thing, it's like you just need to I don't know, it's kind of like put your ego aside and just kind of be very kind of practical as you're approaching the mm-hmm. feedback, which is easier said than done. But I feel like, yeah, the Neil Gaiman quote is like very kind of, you know, apt. It's like whatever they say isn't working, just, you know, really kind of just take a look at it and like, mm-hmm. yeah, just try to be objective about it.
Yeah. I always have to remind myself that I am not, though I say I write for myself, I am not the end user of the product.
Yes.
So I have to think about the reader as well.
Yeah.
And I've talked to writers who like say that, you know, that they have like a person they write to, like they have like a specific person they imagine reading the book, which yes. I think is fascinating. Like, I love the idea of that. I have never really had that experience as a writer, but I like the idea of it.
Yeah. Like, I feel like when I'm writing, like when I'm coming up with story ideas, it's like the first person I'm writing is probably going to sound really self-indulgent. It's like to myself, like the story that, you know, I find just really kind of, you know, exciting because, you know, I'm going to be spending so much time with these characters. I need to be, you know, entertained like while I'm writing mm-hmm. it. And then as I go through edits with my agent and editor, it's like I'm still writing the story I want to write. But then it's like at that point, you know, I'm also trying to like kind of write for the readers as well. Like, you know, when you're kind of taking in like the edits, like when you're kind of approaching the edits, it's like, you know, you want to write your story, but then you also want readers to be able to relate to it. So I think it's kind of a balancing act between those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know. There's a lot of, I just think as a writer, like you never stop learning like craft or storytelling. Like it just like, you know, I just don't want to ever stagnate in that, I guess. Like I just always want to be learning more about how to make the story, but like to serve the work, I guess, almost.
I agree. Like when I go through edits, I just make a note of like, you know, my agents and editors' comments, and then even as I'm going through book two, like I go through their feedback mm-hmm. because I want to, because even like when I signed with my agent Liza, she was just saying, when I just said, how do you kind of see us working together, and it's like, you know, she outlined our plan, but she also just said, you know, when I do like edits and I'm pushing things out, like how I see us working is that, you know, with each book you get better. So, you know, those things where I'm asking you to change up. So my character isn't always saying, you know, he says, she says, that kind of thing. You know, instinctively not to do that for like, you know, it's instinctively what to tackle for the second book. So it's mm-hmm. like just making your prose like tied to your craft like much better as well. And so I think I just like that because it wasn't just about like, you know, selling books, but also as a writer, just, you know, growing and developing with each one. And it's like, I think for me, I want each book to be better than the last. So it's like, I just put like so much pressure on myself to do it. But it's like, yeah, you just want to improve. Yeah. Have you ever seen the film The Menu?
Oh, no, it's been on my list to watch, but I haven't watched it yet.
Oh my God, you should watch it. I won't spoil it for you, but there's just a bit where like Ralph Fiennes just, he invites one of this kind of washed up actor to his like, you know, deadly dinner. But then he just says, oh, you know, I invited you because, you know, it's like you're an example of an artist who's just given up. And it's sort of that thing. It's like, you know, you don't have any like kind of self-respect anymore. So it's like you're just starring in these horrible movies. And he just said, that's a tragedy. And it's like, it's not worth like, you know, trying to kill someone over. But I think it's just that thing. It's like, as an artist, it's like you want to just keep getting better because mm-hmm. it's sort of like you're just kind of like you're wasting other people's time, but then you're also wasting like your own time as well. Yeah. But then it's sort of like pressure that comes with it can just be, mm-hmm. yeah, intense. Yeah.
No, that's great. Oh, well, I'll have to bump it up the queue now.
Definitely. I've watched it over and over like so many times. I'm one of those people, I usually just watch certain scenes, but with this it's like I'll watch it from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have my movie that I watch all the time that my partner gives me all kinds of grief about is Gosford Park.
Oh God, I love that film. Yeah, I've not seen it in years, but like I loved it. Yeah, that was just so
yeah. I mean, intense. It's long, it's involved, but it's the way the story evolves is what I love about it. Like, you yeah. know, I mean, the characters are, I mean, it has a cast of thousands and like truly amazing British actors and actresses. So, but the story is the thing that gets me in that one.
I always loved like the ending reveal as well. Like mm-hmm. it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just yeah. so like tense. Yeah.
And Maggie, oh, not Maggie Smith. It's not. But, oh, her name has fallen out of my head, but it'll come to me. But yeah.
I know who you're talking about. I just like, I'm so bad with names.
Yeah. Well, I have joked and I've thought, it's funny. I thought about this morning, even before you and I were talking that. I always gave my mom so much grief when she would say someone the wrong name or say something wrong. And like, now I get it. It's because my brain is so full all the time. It's like whatever tumbles to the surface is not always the right thing for her. Like, oh, I get it now. I get it now. Yeah. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, because we are a podcast about writing about witchcraft and all of that, is like, yes. What is your personal take on magic in the world, like in the Ooh. Actual life?
I feel like my personal take on magic is the world is like, you know, I hope it exists. And if it does, I'm kind of like, where's my powers? It's like, I want like to be able to like cast like spells. So I feel like I'm not a practitioner, but it's like, you know, I'm very kind of open to kind of, you know, the idea of magic. And mm-hmm. yeah, I would love it if the world was a bit more magical. And I feel like that's why I like writing stories with that touch of the supernatural, because mm-hmm. it's that idea that, you know, magic it exists, but it's always just out of reach. It's sort of like, you know, you're hoping that you'll kind of stumble across it, like when you turn the corner.
Yeah. I would say, and this sounds probably trite and maybe a little cliche, but I would say that you have cast a spell with this book.
Oh, thank you. It's not trite at all.
Oh, good. Because I think, I don't know, like I just love an immersive world. Like to me as a reader, like I love to like, you know, be so in a book and look up and not realize that an hour or two has passed oh. as I'm reading. And it was really that kind of experience. And I don't just say that because you're a guest on the show. Like I truly loved this book and I really hope people will Thank get you. Up and read it. So awesome.
Thank you.
And, you know, my favorite thing is making guests blush and not be able to talk. So
Oh, yeah, you've definitely done that.
Well, good, good, good. And well deserved. Like, I can't wait to read the second book. I'm excited for what's next for you. Speaking Thank of you. Which, before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of plug what's coming up. Like I said, this will come out mid-October. So the book will have been out yes. for a little while, but we'll be getting into the spooky season. So
yes,
do you have
yes.
anything on the horizon and where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram and TikTok at Stacey Thomas Writes, and I'm also on Twitter at Stacey V underscore Thomas. And I think like with my book, yeah, it's like it would have been out for like over 2 months by October. So yeah, no, in time for like Halloween. But it's like I should hopefully be doing like some events around that mm-hmm. time as well. I think I've already got a few coming up in September as well. And then I'm hoping that I would have announced the title for book two, because I'm still kind of like, I'm meant to be handing it into my agent like mid-July. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, I'll be handing it into my editor like by September. So it's like when I'm listening to this in October, I hope I've not jinxed myself. I hope everything would have gone according to plan, but it's like, I should like, if you kind of follow me on socials, I should kind of have like announced the title of my second book and what's it about, but I'll give you some clues. So it's set in London, 1958. So a few centuries later than the rebels. It has a touch of magic, and it basically is set in the world of debutantes. So it's set like in the year that the last debutantes curtsy to the queen. So it's sort of like a dark, it's kind of like, obviously, like with British, and that's the world of the debutantes, but it's sort of that thing. It's like, it's the kind of the deadly debutante. So it's the people who kind of shape society. So like the publicists for the debutantes, the deb's mothers, like, you know, what lengths would they do to see their daughters crowned like Deb of the Year? And then all the people who keep the season going and, like, you know, what's going on in their mind when the Queen suddenly says, oh, the Deb season is over. It's sort of like, you're really going to, like, stop this kind of season that has been going on for, like, centuries. So it's sort of like, it's kind of like the revels in that the world as they knew it is kind of coming to an end, and people are trying to kind of grasp for opportunities, like, for the new world as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. I think you could probably tell I'm still figuring out the story. So by October, it's like, I'll have a better graph, but, like, I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. Well, it feels kind of timely too with, like, you know, the coronation and all of that.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of change. So good job on that, I guess, too.
Thank you. Yeah. I actually have, like, some fun bits, like, with Queen Elizabeth, like, the second, like, her original coronation and kind of, like, how that ties into 1958. So it's sort of like, if you kind of like royal conspiracies, then yeah, hopefully Book Two will be up your street.
Yeah, I would say I'm not a royalist, but I love all the intrigue and the comeuppance.
Yeah. Like, with my book, like, I'm not like, I feel like I'm not like a royalist as well, because I feel like sometimes the level of attention is just it's over the top and a bit kind of like creepy as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like, The royal family don't like play a role. They're not like main characters at all. They're kind of just like mentioned in passing. But yeah, hopefully.
Awesome. Well, cool. So our last question is, like I said, a tiny game of chance, and I will roll a die. And depending on what I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll six, you get to pick. And you can always say pass if this is not the one you want. We have very minimal, or I say no rules, but I guess, I mean, technically there are minimal rules to the game. So five, money.
Ooh, yes.
Okay.
So is the question is like, if there's like something as a writer I'm absolutely not willing to do for free, or like,
I have another one for you. I write new ones for everybody.
Oh, okay. Ooh, all right. I'm looking forward to it. Ooh, okay. Yes.
So now that you are in the publishing industry,
yes,
what can you say about the good and bad of it as a writer? Like, what has surprised you, and what's been like, oh, I didn't think that was how that worked?
Ooh. So I feel like what surprised me is how hard it is to basically make a living from writing. Like, I kind of like mm-hmm. knew beforehand, like, you know, when I was like writing it before I got my agent, but then it's sort of that thing where you kind of like really get deep into the writing community on like Twitter. Like, I realized that, you know, you can be published once, but there's no guarantee you'll continue to be like published. So it's sort of that thing. It's like, unless you're a brand author, you're never really secure. And I just remembered reading this interview with, you know, Leigh Bardugo, who's got like this massive deal, and like her books are brilliant. But like, I think one of her early interviews, she just said that, you know, when her first book, the kind of Grisha series, was published, like, it did really well. But she just said, you know, that was her first book. You can't build your career on one book. So it's sort of the thing. It's like, she was writing, like, she writes like one book a year to kind of keep building her brand, keep building her audience. And like, as a new writer, it just made me realize that, you know, unless you're really lucky, like, you know, this career like can take real like years to build. So It's sort of that thing. It's like, you can be a talented writer, but then it's sort of like, it can just be down to luck sometimes. Then also, you know, having the right editor, having like, you know, the right people on your team who believe on you, who kind of want to keep like building the buzz. And then I would also say, like, what I found, like, to end with something a bit more positive, like, what I found like quite surprising is, I think we mentioned earlier that, you know, publishing can be quite like cliquey at times, and kind of like, I think, unwelcoming, especially if like you're a new writer. And so as someone who's quite introverted, like, what I've like really loved was just how welcoming, like, because I'm part of like a few debut groups, and it's like, I really love making friends with other writers. And like, you know, when I got my publishing deal, like, and even before that, that was something I had, you know, dreamt about. And it was that thing, it's like, I really love making genuine friendships with other writers, because you just feel less alone on the journey. And It's like, I met up with a few of them, and I'm going to be meeting up with another like talented writer in Scotland and attending another writer's like book launch, like, while I'm there as well. But yeah, it's like, this time last year, I never thought I would have, like, you know, so many, like, writer friends and, like, you know, genuine friends. So that's been, like, probably one of the best parts of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the outside, and especially from, like, movies and books about publishing and writing, like, writers are kind of cutthroat with each other. And I'm like, I mean, yes, I have experienced writers whose personalities were standoffish and, like, you know, please don't address me or whatever, but they're very rare. I think most writers that I've encountered are genuinely interested in a craft. So they're interested in other people who are also writers. And it's, you have a commonality to talk about in a vocation, like you said, that is pretty lonely. Like, I mean, most of the time it's just you and a keyboard. So,
So like, that's definitely been the highlight. Like, I have met, like, you know, some of those kind of competitive or, like, standoffish writers. And I just feel like, you know, in real life, it's like with writing, it's like, I'm writing around work. So it's that thing. It's like, I don't need to engage with those writers. Like, if someone is standoffish or rude, it's like, I don't need to give them the time of day. I can just move on and, like, you know, find my real friends who would never dream of acting like that. So,
No, I feel lucky that I fell in with a group of writers, and most of my close friend writers are romance writers. And I have a couple of people who write multiple genres, but I have a lot of romance writer friends, and, you know, that's a whole different world to me. Like, I love the idea of what they're doing, because it is very, you know, they write very commercial fiction, and they do, you know, most of them are independently published or hybrids. And they do, and they do well. I mean, that, you know, it's what, over 50% of the publishing industry is romance. So I feel like I've learned so much from them, because they have so much more insight on the commercial end of publishing.
Yes.
And I kind of straddle that idea between writing commercial fiction and literary fiction. Like, I kind of sit on that fence a lot. So it's really nice to kind of get the insight of, you know, people who know how to sell books, frankly.
Like, as much as I love, you know, historical fiction, like, you know, that's the genre I write in, I also love, like, interacting with authors who are writing completely different genres as well. Like, it's just good to just just see what different areas of, like, publishing is like
Awesome. Well, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing this beautiful book, and like I said, I really hope people go now, run, do not walk, and buy the book. It is like, you know, when I decided to call the podcast Witchlit, like, I really thought I would get to have a lot more fiction writers on. It's been a little harder to get fiction folks on, and I interview a lot of nonfiction folks, which I also love, but it feels like a treat to get to, you know, interview someone who's writing fiction too. So thank you.
You're welcome. Like, I've loved, like, speaking with you, and, like, yeah, no, thank you for just being such an amazing host, and yeah, it's been such a lovely chat as well.
Well, we will have to talk soon when your next book comes out.
Yes, no, definitely.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.